When I decided I wanted to start this platform, one of the very first topics I knew I wanted to address was pornography consumption. And I guess I've been hearing more about it recently, but honestly, I just knew intuitively that it's got to be becoming a progressively more and more important topic, but it's one I just don't see a whole lot of resources focused on. It's rare to come across what I think of as credible training on the topic or clinicians who advertise as treating porn addiction, but they do exist. In my research, I found a marriage and family therapist named Michael Anderson, who specializes in supporting men who want to reduce or completely stop porn consumption. And I came across some voice memos he recorded that were just to the point and personal and caught my attention right away. Here's one of those voice memos where he's talking about the topic of facing your triggers.
All right, I want to share some thoughts with you that will hopefully help you avoid a very common pitfall that people fall into when they're trying to outgrow pornography, and that is they try and put a bunch of buffers between themselves and their triggers, right? The things that seem to evoke a urge in them to want to view pornography. All right, I've talked with people who have content, who've tried content blockers, who have tried deleting apps off their phone, things like that. So here's kind of my story. So a big trigger avoider for me was the gym. I didn't like going to the gym because I'd see women that were attractive and it would evoke this sexual response in me, and there was a lot of shame and resistance towards it, and I'd feel really bad for it. And I think a lot of guys have that mentality. We'll use the gym, for example, right? Of, oh man, I don't want to go into the gym, is so hard because then I get these urges to view pornography afterwards. It just triggers me so much. Maybe I should try something else. Or I can't go on to YouTube because then I just get an urge to start searching for things. Or I can't be alone in my room with my laptop because then I start getting this urge. You get it, right? Now the thing is, and we're not just trying to manage a behavior, we're trying to outgrow it. And so the only way to outgrow it is to actually face the triggers. The reality is, we are not bad for being sexual beings. Sexuality is not bad at all. It's not bad that we feel sexual urges. It's not bad that things trigger sexual urges. It is not bad at all. And the more we treat our triggers as like these big, scary things that bring out scary things in us, bad things in us, then the more we have this like forbidden quality around urges and sexuality, which actually make the urges way more powerful if there's like a forbiddenness to them. The truth is, no urge is forbidden. No urge is too powerful for you. No urge makes you bad or gross. And so what we want to do is actually practice facing our triggers. So for me, going to the gym was a lot like going to the gym, doing my thing, and then when I saw an attractive girl, instead of jumping into this big shame spiral and battling and resisting, allowing curiosity to take over and say, oh, yep, that is an attractive woman. I'm really grateful that my body's working. And then allow myself to move on. See, a lot of times we ruminate with our urges, right? Rumination is just like, I can't get this urge to turn off, to shut off. Rumination happens when we are in a stress response. We don't ruminate when we're not in a stress response. One of the biggest things that will determine whether or not you have a stress response or not is, are you willing to just be curious and open and normalize what you're experiencing? Normalization is one of the best ways to get out of a stress response, because if you're in a stress response, then by definition, you think something not normal is happening. And so when I would be at the gym and I'd see an attractive girl, saying, oh yeah, that makes sense that my body is attracted to her. I'm grateful that my body is responding that way. Good to know. And now it's time for me to move on. There's in acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a really awesome therapy. I pull from it a lot. There's this term called facing the dinosaur, which basically means, you know, there are these scary things in our life that we spend so much time running away from, fighting and trying to ignore, like a big scary dinosaur. But if we actually just turned to it, faced it, and saw it for what it was, we'd actually realize it's not nearly as scary as we thought it was. And so I tell my clients all the time, a lot of outgrowing pornography is about finally facing the dinosaur. Like, go to the gym and face it with curiosity, with openness, normalize it, let it be there, and realize that it's okay. And it's not nearly as scary or as painful as your mind has believed it to be. If you have any questions for me, if there's anything you want me to address in a future episode, like, I would just love to hear from you guys. Just think the world of you.
My name is Tobin Richardson. I'm a counselor educator with a vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast style platform designed for learning. And as I alluded to before, I can't think of a more relevant current topic to know about as a therapist than pornography consumption, because, of course, as obvious, we all have access to unlimited graphic content these days right at our fingertips. It'd be way easier to find than this podcast. And most studies show that the average age of first exposure to porn is between 11 and 13 years old, sometimes unintentionally. And as a mental health professional, it's hard for me not to think about what that means for development and long-term sexual functioning. But then on the other side of the coin, I also understand just how fundamentally faulty societal messages around sex can be. There's so much judging and shaming and embarrassment, just otherwise inaccurate information about sex that can be so embedded into our clients' minds. And so, of course, this applies to porn as well. And one of the people I knew could help me make sense of this topic is Dr. Heather Sexton, who's a therapist who's certified by ASECT, which is the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, as a sex therapist, which means she has a lot of advanced education on the topic, not to mention experience, as much of her private practice work focuses on sex therapy specifically. Here she is discussing how these societal messages can use porn as a scapegoat for something that's far more multifaceted.
I don't see pornography as the problem. Like, the problem is the villainization of, like, sex in general, like the discomfort around talking about sex, teaching people about sex. We, like, scoop back into pornography, and, like, this is one of the only spaces where you get to see sex. Whether it's realistic or not, you get to see, like, okay, so this is what I do. This is how I start that. That's what that looks like. And so, like, this is one of the only avenues that we have to gain information. Like, of course, right? But with that is, like, because of all of the sneakiness and, like, villainization of sex, nobody ever says, hey, this is not what's actually going to happen when you initiate sex with a partner. It's not going to look like that at all. There's probably going to be some weird noises, smells. It's going to look different. It's going to be awkward, and it is not going to look like it does on a porn. But because it's so secretive and because it's such an uncomfortable conversation, like, that doesn't happen. So then we have to, like, kind of figure out our own. And so if all we've seen is this, it is certainly disappointing when our partner isn't orgasmic at our touch, right? Like, that's like, oh, okay, so I must be, like, doing something wrong. I didn't do the right thing. Or maybe it's my partner. Something's wrong, you know? And so, like, all of this gets tangled up into, like, one of the few things that we have to, like, learn a little bit about this important part of our lives, right? Pornography is, you know, and I tell couples a lot, because sometimes that is the issue that they're coming in for, and it's not necessarily about pornography. It's like, you know, there's an issue around, like, insecurity. I don't feel good. I'm comparing myself. Or, like, you know, my partner isn't even considering me sexually. And so there's like, porn gets like the blame, you know, and there's definitely for sure, pornography to some people could be almost like a regulating tool. And I've seen that too, where like maybe it is too much to the point of like they've harmed themselves. And which that takes a lot, but that does happen too. But then it's about something else. It's like, you know, there's some impulsivity issue, or, you know, there's something else that like gets blamed on pornography. Because I think really and truly, like, pornography is a tool, you know? So most of the time it ends up being, this is something that helps me masturbate. This is a tool that I use to, like, you know, bring arousal or excitement, or I mean, just, you know, I'm utilizing it because I need a release. We're aroused and excited by things that are different and novel. And so a lot of the times it's like unraveling that more. And that's where pornography, because, you know, it's this thing that, because sex is villainized so much, it's this thing that is villainized as well, when there's like so many layers to what's actually happening. And a lot of like sex therapy is kind of unraveling those things, and whatever that is for that person, like whatever they're presenting in the room. But I don't ever villainize pornography, because like, it's serving a function of some sort, whether that's just because you want to go masturbate. And there's not a ton of people that can like just imagine in their heads and like that's enough. So I try to like normalize. Nobody has like a Rolodex of images, and they're like, or nobody's pulling out a photo of their partner out of their wallets. Like, come on, long-term relationship, that's like unrealistic. It's okay to be attracted and aroused by things that are different. And maybe that's scary for a relational paradigm, you know?
Heather went on to talk about how she's seen porn be useful in relationships for a lot of different reasons, a lot of which are very nuanced to each individual or situation. And opening the door to honest conversation and exploration is a big part of how therapists can help their clients to navigate all this. But sometimes that takes an exploration of our own barriers and biases and how those might be creeping into the therapy space, sometimes reinforcing this obstructive notion that sex is something that isn't okay to talk about openly and should be secretive. Another clinician I've heard discuss this topic in depth and very directly is Dr. Samantha Witten, who's a psychologist who talks a lot about very specific sex-related topics. Things like foreplay and orgasms and sexless marriage and, of course, porn. She talks about it in a way that's totally unfiltered and unembarrassed and real. It feels like you're just talking to a friend. I came across her through a podcast called Dr. Psych Mom, where I heard her talk about how porn impacts relationships specifically, usually focusing on long-term monogamous heterosexual couples. She's generally more skeptical of porn consumption, and in her private practice, she's noticed patterns of negative impacts. So those are what she discusses often. Here she is.
Ask me whatever you want to talk about, and I will be honest and talk to you about it.
Okay, that sounds great. So the first thing that's popped up in my head is like, how has issues surrounding porn consumption changed over your career, or have they? Have you noticed any difference in the last, like, let's say, decade?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so when I started writing my blog and really being on my own in private practice was in 2014, so it's 10 years ago now. And it was very different. There wasn't a negative connotation to porn in the way that there is now, except among very religious people. And that's also because people aren't using it as much, you know. Now it's really ubiquitous with smartphone use. I mean, it was hard to like lug your laptop into the shower, you know what I mean? So like you couldn't really do that. And of course, the laptop was after, like, it used to just be like magazines, you know. And the more interactive it is, then the more dopamine is released, the more intense the experience is. you know, and we're only going further in that domain to like virtual reality and sex robots and all these different things in the future. But things are getting much, much more intense. They're getting more interactive. OnlyFans wasn't a thing then. So the thing is that when women watch, they often watch with a partner, but some of them watch alone. The young women, they want to see, like some women are just doing it for arousal. But young women are doing it to see what's expected. So you've got like a lot of young women that think that you're supposed to do all this crazy stuff, you know, that they're not ready to do. But they think, just like you would watch a TikTok, a makeup tutorial to know how to do your makeup as a young woman, you would watch this to know how to act in bed. And it really separates you from the experience because then there's such a performative aspect. You assume that your partner has seen all of this. You're trying to act a certain way. There are things that people, women think that they're supposed to do as a performance before they've even explored how to have an orgasm. Yeah, I mean, it's really very sad to think that before you're even understanding that sex is for pleasure, you think of it as a performance and that you're comparing yourself to women who look a certain way and act a certain way.
Do we have enough like longitudinal data? I'm curious about, let's say if that's part of your developmental experience of like your first experiences with sex, what's sex like for you 10 years later, or 15 years later? Maybe we don't know that yet.
Yeah, I don't think that we know that from the proliferation now. I do know, obviously, I'm in private practice, so qualitatively or anecdotally, it's a lot of women feel that when they did view pornography at an early age, it was at the behest of a partner, and they did feel like it wasn't as comfortable as they would want to be because when you, especially if you have nothing to compare it to, then you just assume that you're being told to act a certain way. And to some degree, you are. You know, it would be like a girl showing her boyfriend a video of like a romantic proposal, you know, but like, and of course he correctly assumes, oh, she would really like that. So like if you're watching porn with your partner, and this is a woman of any age, if you're watching porn with your partner, you got to assume that what he puts on is what he'd like you to do. So then it kind of just erases what you might like to do. Like you don't even really think about it. You know, you think, oh, this is supposed to go a certain way. Yeah. You know, and it's interesting because a lot of women use, and I talk about like, I have a podcast episode, there is a kind of porn that's good for sex lives. What is it? And so I talk about erotica, like erotic stories, because a lot of, so if your goal is to get the sex drives closer together, which it is for most couples, or many couples, then the woman's will go higher within monogamy, long-term monogamy, and the man's would go to whatever his set point is without the artificial inflation of porn on his libido. And so for women, a lot of times erotica is useful. Like either it's like dirt, you know, like dirty scenes in books or just erotic stories on the internet. A, because it could put them in the mood, but also because a lot of women, as I said from before, don't even know what they would like. So like if you read about various things, then you're like, oh, maybe I like that. Maybe I like that. So men kind of know what they would like, you know. And so it's really not as, maybe some of them don't when they're young, but it's not like there's a lot of women begging the husband to say, please tell me. There are some, please tell me what you would like. But it's much more the other way, where men say to a woman, oh, tell me what you would like. And they're like, I'm supposed to like something? Like, what are the options here? They don't even know. So like, there are ways that like reading about sex, and there's like this site, OMG, yes, oh my God, yes, that like talks about different ways to stimulate sexually for people that don't know. And obviously, like I have a sexologist at my practice. I talk with people about sex, not as in depth as she does, but certainly during therapy, there are many sex positive therapists. There are sex therapists, you know, who could talk with people about these things. And there are ways to learn more about sex and what you like and this and that. But usually it's not like hardcore visual porn videos, you know, like that doesn't usually teach people necessarily much. And in fact, it teaches men a lot of the absolute wrong thing. Because it doesn't teach them how to give a woman an orgasm. It makes them think that intercourse leads to an orgasm right away. It makes them think that women are going to be super excited immediately to be touched all these different ways, including very roughly. And it just kind of, And then when their wives or girlfriends don't respond that way, they think that there is something wrong with the woman. And sometimes the woman is asexual or super low libido, but many times she's just being compared to something that isn't real, as though like the man's build was being compared to Captain America, you know, instead of like an average man of his height, you know. It's just like the comparison point is so crazily wrong, you know, that it really is. It's amazing for men to see it, like when they go off of porn for a few weeks, even just a few weeks. A lot of guys, especially when they're older, like middle age and up, they're like, I'm like, not, I don't even get hard. Like, you know what, like during the day, like I thought I had like the sex drive of a 25-year-old guy, but now that I'm not looking at porn all the time to prime myself and to fluff myself, I don't, you know, and my set point is a lot more like my wife, who wants to do it once a week. Like, now I want to do it like twice a week, three times a week. She wants to do it once a week. That's a lot more, you know, reconcilable than if a man thought he wanted to do it twice a day because he was using porn twice a day. Men do not have to have the sex drive of the artificial porn inflation, which makes you think that there's 100 women ready, 1,000, 1,000,000 women ready to go all the time, exactly your physical type, young, fertile women that just want to be with you. That's what it feels like when you're looking at the screen.
From your experience, do you feel like most people sense that that's a problem? Like, sense that that excessive porn use is a problem? Or do you normally like have to make that argument to them?
A lot of women don't like it. I mean, but they don't really know what to say, because sometimes the man will give them if you don't do it with me as much as I need it, which, because they're using porn every day, they think is every day or twice a day or something, or every other day, you know, then if you don't do that, well, then how could you not want me to just get my needs met? Right. And so then that kind of seems logical until you realize that that's actually raising their set point artificially and keeping them kind of in this lust wonderland where they don't really know reality. But yes, many, many, many women don't like it. But other women, in fact, don't want me to say that to the husband, because the husband primarily uses porn. So basically, it's an open secret that he takes a long, you know, time in the bathroom, or he goes to sleep first or later, or he stays up, and then he doesn't ask her for sex, you know, because he just has primarily using porn. And so at that stage, she and he both feel that it's a substitute, and it's like alcohol. It's just the same as like if I told a man to stop drinking and then he would interact more with his wife, and she was like, but I like him passed out every day at 8 p.m. then I get to do whatever I want, like, and we don't really get along anyway, and why are you making a problem? So sometimes it's like that. I mean, if a couple wants to grow closer, then reducing porn is really a great idea. If they are somehow have agreed to be in some sort of monogamous arrangement where they're still married but they don't really want to have any sex, well, then I guess he could kind of go do whatever he wants then. But there's, you know, I mean, assuming that he's morally okay with whatever, you know, porn is not consensual that he may see, but without that part, fine. But I work with couples generally who are trying to get closer together, and in that case, porn is an obstacle, and usually with education about it, people are at least willing to try to not do it.
What's your advice, or what are techniques you suggest to be able to break that? Like, what really kind of sounds like an addiction in many cases? Do you suggest cold turkey, like get rid of the phone?
I do suggest cold turkey. A lot of times people use support groups. You know, there is Sex Addicts Anonymous, and there's a lot of porn addicts with sex addicts. And this is not just, it's not a sex addict if a guy just wants to have sex. You know, obviously sex addicts are the ones who are destroying their lives and messing up at work and messing their relationships up. And it's the same thing with porn, you know, where you can't stop. So at first they say, well, why don't you just try to stop for a week? And the guy's like, oh yeah, sure. And many guys can, and they're very surprised. And when they can't, and they're irritable, and then they end up using it late night anyway, then they start to realize, oh, I guess that was more of a problem. And then it's the same sort of thing, working like, what are your values? What could you get out of this? How could you power through it one day at a time? Do you need support, help, etc.?
Yes, it's so interesting that with as pervasive, I think, as we all accept, probably clinicians in general accept, like this is a problem that could be impacting a lot of relationships. There's so little education, like on all these things. Like so much of it I've never even thought about, like how the performative aspect and like then trying what you see in porn on your partner. I'm curious if you think like too many clinicians are scared of this topic. I don't know.
Well, sex in general. I mean, I have so many people come in and they're like, oh, we were in couples counseling for the past 5 years. We never talked about sex. Past 10 years, we never talked about sex. Or you forget about even porn. They don't even talk about sex. Talking about porn is generally something that's only, I mean, sure, sex therapists may talk about it, but like usually it's just religious, like pastoral counselors or something will advise against it and say it's bad. And then that's kind of it. That's like where the conversation ends. And meanwhile, it's happening. You know, I mean, it's like just something that's not talked about. And if people aren't comfortable talking about it, therapists are people too. And if they're not comfortable talking about it or about sex in general, then they just don't. And there's always enough stuff to talk about without it. You know, so it really gets shoved under the rug. And when it's, and there's also this kind of myth that like when the emotional component of the relationship would improve, then the sex life improves in lockstep. And that is obviously untrue from anybody who's then worked with the people who come in and they're like, yeah, we know how to say our I feel statements and we understand about our families of origin and we still don't have sex, you know, or we have terrible sex or he's still a porn addict or whatever. So yes, there people are very uncomfortable about it. And I think that more education is great. And also I try to advocate and educate clients that when they want to come in to see somebody, a couples therapist or an individual therapist, just make sure that the person at least is comfortable talking about sex, is sex positive, talks about it on their profile. I mean, you know, something. Not yeah. Just we engage, we talk about communication and, you know, division of labor, but we also talk about sex, porn, etc. openly.
I have to mention, wrapping up this piece, that ASECT, the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, actually doesn't consider sex addiction or porn addiction as mental health disorders because of the lack of empirical evidence that exists to make this connection. The organization has published articles like one titled, "Is Porn Problematic? It's Complicated," which I think is where I'm walking away from this piece at as well. I guess like with everything else in our field, there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. We shouldn't paint with a broad brush, which could be tempting, in part because of all the messages we often get about sex, usually that are very simple and prescriptive and often include shame. Faulty messages like, it's okay in these certain ways, within these certain parameters only. So addressing those notions while also encouraging our clients to be mindful of their consumption and its impact is the type of nuanced approach which might be necessary.